This is Dr. Richard Perrone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. John McNown, Jr. I'm again in Lubbock, Texas. Today is December 18, 2003, and it is 8:37 a.m. Central Standard Time. And Mr. McNown, you are in Mission, Kansas. Sir, let's pick up where we left off yesterday. We had been discussing some general things, and I wanted to ask you one thing that affected your daily life, I would imagine, was the enemy. Could you describe, in general terms, your impressions of the NVA and the Viet Cong?
Naturally, I didn't like them much. I guess you
right.
can start off with that. And from a general impression, I think two things stand out. Number one is we didn't have a whole lot of respect for the Viet Cong in some ways, and that's just simply because they were smart enough. They didn't have the weaponry. They didn't stand up and fight, and so, you know, and when you did run into them, they certainly weren't as well trained and just didn't seem to, as we used to say, have their act together. You know, they were pretty easy to, if they did decide to stand and fight, they were pretty easy to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the NVA were you know, well trained, well motivated. I mean, they were just hardcore people, and we had a lot of respect for the NVA. Didn't want to run into them necessarily because they had adapted their tactics to the fact that we had overwhelming firepower. And so, as I think I mentioned someplace yesterday, we used to say, you know, they'd let you get close enough to kiss you before they'd open up.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, of course, they would maneuver on you. Just very disciplined troops, most of the ones we ran into. And and so we had a great deal of respect for them. In terms of, of course, the first people I ran into, because we were operating in the coastal plain, were Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
And they were usually operating in small groups, which made them easier to handle, of course. You'd see anywhere from 4 to 7, maybe, at a time, almost a fire team kind of group.
Mm-hmm.
And they were usually, you know, they were wearing whatever the people in that area, whether they were villages or farmers or whatever, would be wearing most of the time. And they were armed with, you know, M16s, AK-47s, old French, you know, rifles, just about anything they could get their hands on.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that was, that, you know, we really didn't like about the Viet Cong was their ability to, you know, use booby traps and mines to their advantage, which was in Quang Ngai province. That was a, you know, we just had booby trap casualties, it seemed like, at least every week, and in some areas you'd have them every day. And that's pretty hard on the morale of the troops. And that's why up in Pinkville, which is where Milai was, they tended to rotate people in and out of there and didn't leave you very long, which is because that was an area where every day you could count on losing somebody to a booby trap. And that's just frustrating to people, you know. The Viet Cong were almost like an irritant, and except they'd get on your nerves. Whereas the NVA, that was like running into an elephant when you'd run into a good-sized force, the NVA. I mean, they were going to stand and fight, and they were going to maneuver and it was real combat when you did that.
Okay. All right. What would you say were the main strengths of the NVA?
Discipline. They had good fire discipline, most of the people we ran into. And they usually tried to choose a place where they wanted to fight. We usually would either be dug in and they'd hit us, or we would run into them after they were dug in. Occasionally you'd catch them out in the open someplace, and then it was a lot more, you know, it was pretty unequal at that point if you saw them first.
Mm-hmm.
But just just seemed to, you know, to be a fairly disciplined, fairly well led fighting force. And the one thing they didn't have was good communication. If you could separate them out, there wasn't very good communication. They didn't have the radio communications that we did. So a lot of times they would pre-plan their attack, and when something went bad, the people that were succeeding wouldn't know that something had gone bad somewhere else in the line.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could pretty much, you know, defeat them in detail. Then.
Right.
So that I didn't think that the communications was probably there. That, and they just didn't have the firepower. They didn't have the artillery and that kind of things. Occasionally they were using the, I think they were 120-millimeter mortars,
mm-hmm.
which were similar to our four deuces, and they had 82-millimeter mortars and a lot of RPGs, but they certainly didn't have, you know, any air support, helicopter support, or artillery
right.
down in our area. So they were at a disadvantage as far as firepower went
okay.
a lot of times.
What kind of tactics would they employ usually?
Most of the time, when we ran into them, which was usually out in the mountains. They did come down, and I was out of the field then, but in 69, they came down onto the coastal plain, and so it was a little different then. But most of the time, they would try to set up an ambush and hope you walked into it, and they would be usually dug in fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
And camouflaged well. They were really good at camouflage.
How would they usually camouflage, or typically camouflage?
They would, if they were dug in, they would make sure that, you know, they still had, you know, bushes that appeared to be natural in front of their positions, would be dug in behind hedgerows a lot. When they were down on the, when they did come into the coastal plains, they would set up behind hedgerows
mm-hmm.
and the hedgerows were very thick there. I mean, that was something that surprised me, because I always, you know, you hear about the hedgerows in France and
yes.
in World War II, and I'd never heard anything about hedgerows in Vietnam, but certainly in the Duc Pho area, there was hedgerows every place, and they were very thick, and you couldn't get through them unless there was an opening someplace,
mm-hmm.
or you blew something out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they would dig in behind the hedgerows with fields of fires across the rice paddies, and that was a pretty tough thing to, if you got out in the middle of the rice paddy and they opened up on you, it was pretty hard to get any kind of maneuver other than straight ahead against something like that. So,
right.
I would say they were pretty clever in their attack methods. We got hit one time at night in, outside of Hawthorne Special Forces camp, and I mean, it took everything we had to keep from getting overrun. And we were fortunate enough, we called in final protective fires the night before, you know, targeted them in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the only thing that kept us from being overrun.
Wow.
They were very, very persistent, hardcore people.
Okay. And you all had a measure of respect for that.
Yes, we did. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty hard not to respect people that don't have the firepower you do and keep coming anyway. So,
mm-hmm. John, why don't we pick up with one of the questions I asked yesterday about your daily activities, and we began to discuss going out on ambush and things like that. And I'd like to know a little bit more about your daily activities.
Okay. And I think yesterday we talked about we would dig in somewhere in late afternoon, and then usually one platoon would, this was down in the coastal plains, would which is where a lot of our activity took place.
Mm-hmm.
We were supposed to be trying to make sure that the population was friendly to the South Vietnamese government and protect the what they call the rural development area from the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we were very successful at that. I read a book not too long ago that said 80% of the population of Quang Nai province remained loyal to the north through the entire war. There was only one of two provinces that they felt they had control of for the entire war.
Mm-hmm.
And we always felt that way, that the population, you know, just really didn't like us much.
How could you tell? Or maybe that's not such a smart question, but
it was just because of all the booby traps in the mines, and you knew people had to know that mm-hmm. they were out there, and they'd be out farming, and you'd hit a booby trap, and they'd all just be kind of sitting there, you know, and then occasionally, especially when we were up in the Pinkville, we did some things that probably weren't in accordance with the Geneva Convention. A couple of times when we've been hitting booby traps every day, we actually pulled some villagers out and put them in front of us,
mm-hmm.
and we never hit a booby trap.
Okay.
And they would actually all of a sudden come back and stop and tell us we couldn't go someplace. So they obviously knew where they were.
Okay. How many times did you do that?
I think twice. We never shot anybody or did anything about it, but a couple of times when we hit three or four booby traps in an area, in a single morning, we finally just pulled some people out and had them guide us to the next place we were supposed to go.
When you say pulled some people out, what do you mean by that?
We just went into a village and rounded up some civilians and put them in front of the point man.
Okay.
And just went down a trail. We were supposed to be going, to a next place, some other place. And we put them on the trail on the way to go, and then they would stop and indicate that there was something there, and then we'd bypass that, and they'd show us something else. And so it was obviously the local population had an idea of where this stuff was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we did that twice, as I remember. And both times it was up north of Quang Ngai City and out toward the Batanian Peninsula, which is... Norman Schwarzkopf said when he was on TV a few years ago with Dan Rather, is a badass place. And so,
mm-hmm. Would you agree with that assessment?
Oh, yeah, it was terrible. I mean, just lost people every single day and never saw anybody.
Hmm.
And that's frustrating. And that's why I say they didn't leave people in there.
Right.
And sometimes you lose lots of people. So,
right.
Getting back to the daily activity,
mm-hmm.
So we would dig in, eat, and sometimes they'd bring us a hot meal in the evening, and a lot of times they wouldn't, and then we'd send out usually two platoons on ambush patrol, and they'd go out as far as maybe 7 kilometers.
Did you rotate platoons? How did you select them?
Yeah, usually two would go out one day, and then the next day one would, and a lot of times you would move someplace during the day, and then a different platoon would stay and guard the perimeter at night.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes guarding the perimeter was almost worse than going out on patrol, because you'd have this pretty good sized area to guard, and you wouldn't be able to put as many people, into a guard position as normal. So you didn't get as much sleep doing that either. So anytime we were actually patrolling two platoons at a time, nobody was getting much sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd go out on the patrol, and most of the time you didn't hit anything. And we talked about when I first got there, I think I was lost all the time. There was no point of references out in the paddies, and you'd hit these hedgerows. And I forgot to mention we carried a compass, also.
Right.
When we were talking about what we carried. But and so you'd be trying to go with your compass, and get under your poncho with your flashlight and figure out where you were and take off. And you'd hit a hedgerow, and all of a sudden you'd have to move several hundred meters in some strange direction before you could get through it. And then you'd try to get back online so that you could find where you were supposed to be going. And then you'd come across a stream, and you'd have to find a place to ford the stream. And so a lot of times it was just, especially when I first got there, and I was a pretty good map reader in the States, and even in Panama had done a decent job. But when I got it there on the rice paddies with the hedgerows and the streams, it was a lot different kind of environment to be moving through, and you almost couldn't terrain navigate. It was just because of these hedgerows that, didn't show up on anything, that and the next thing you'd be moving and you'd get through it on one side, and a lot of times if there was a trail, there'd be a hedgerow on each side of the trail, and you'd get through in this one spot, but there wouldn't be someplace else, directly across from it to get through the hedge. And you'd have to move up or down the trail until you found a hole to get out the other side. And by that time, you couldn't see anything on either side. So it was,
right.
it was very difficult. Matter of fact, a funny thing happened at our reunion in St. Louis. My our 81 FO, who was part of the platoon headquarters area unit, and he'd been there quite a while when I showed up, and we were all talking. Of course, all the fellows from a lot of the fellows from the platoon were already there, and we were kidding around, and he walked up, and he said, "Well, John, did you ever learn to read a map after I left?" and that was a huge joke for the whole time, because all the rest of them thought I could read a map, pretty well, and I could by the time he left, but when I first got there out in the paddies, it was terrible at night.
Yes.
And so we'd go out, we'd do the patrol, and usually with the ambush, and usually it was a five. Sometimes as many as 10 men, you might have a whole squad, but usually it's 5 to 7 people. You'd set up and hope you didn't hit anything a lot of the time, because sometimes when you hit something, you didn't know if it was the beginning of a larger unit. You weren't sure what you're getting into.
How could you tell what size you were running into? Was it just a matter of time?
Yeah, it was just a matter of time. If you looked up and you saw 5 or 7 guys, and you would blow your claymores, you usually put your claymores out and then open up.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that never happened to me, but I have friends that it happened to, that would be bad. It turned out that might be the point squad of a company, or especially later on when the NVA started moving around in the coastal plain.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing you know, you had a whole group of people getting online assaulting through your ambush position. And that was not a good thing to do, So you hoped, you didn't want to miss the people that went through, but sometimes later on they'd let those people go through and see if there was anybody coming after them, and then you would miss both groups if there wasn't,
Right.
So what you did when you saw a larger group was usually, you waited till you could pull back and then try to call artillery in on them after they moved up the trail a little bit. You try to estimate where they'd be and call artillery in on them. Then in the daytime, we'd pull back into the, after first light, we'd pull back into the company perimeter, have some breakfast, and then we'd move off to wherever we were going to sweep that day, or whatever the mission, which a lot of times it was, move from here to here and check out these things, and then we'd set up again for the night.
How fatigued were you, John?
What? Excuse me?
How fatigued were you?
You were tired. I mean, you just, and after a while, you just got used to it, but you were just, I literally could sleep standing up after I'd been there about 2 months.
Wow.
You could stand up against a tree and catch 5 minutes. I mean, you could sleep, after 2 weeks, you could sleep anytime you got 5 minutes. You could just instantly go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't as bad. My platoon sergeant wouldn't let me pull guard duty. And so I, the first month or so I got over there, probably after I got used to the mosquitoes and things, probably got more sleep than I ever got in my life, because Sergeant Wright didn't think officers should pull guard duty. So it'd start getting dark, and you'd go to sleep, and you'd wake up just before first light. And when we were in it, the company was dug in together. Then just before first light, you'd wake everybody up and get in position, because, there was, I don't know where that must have come. I don't know where it came from, but the NVA liked to attack just before first light.
I
never saw that happen, but I'm sure there was some reason for that. At Benning, they had lots of after-action reports that would mention that, that right before first light, that, some unit would get hit.
Right.
That was a different situation. And as I say, you'd eat, and then at some point, you'd kind of hump until, somebody decided it was time to take a break, and you hoped that you were toward the front of the unit if the whole unit was moving. Because, a company with 100 people, and it's probably spread out over close to a mile, especially if you're in single file.
Mm-hmm.
And so the company commander would get up there, he'd take his 5 minutes and decide the break was over, and the people in the rear were still pulling into the area.
Right.
And so if you were toward the back, a lot of times you never got to stop moving.
Mm-hmm.
And And then sometimes you go off during the day and operate as a platoon, where you know, they tell you, okay, first platoon, go off to the left, and you go out and search this village over here, and you know, and then the CP and usually the mortar people would stay in a central position when we did that,
mm-hmm.
and we would report back into them what we'd found or something. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty much a typical day down in the when we were out off a fire base in the coastal plain, and then when we were in guarding a fire base, you'd leave one platoon on the fire base. It would really work pretty much the same way,
mm-hmm.
except sometimes you would, depending on the size of the fire base, you couldn't put out as many patrols if you had too much area to cover, too many bunkers. But sometimes we'd be left as many as just a single person in a bunker because we had so many patrols out, not enough people to do it.
Okay.
And and then when you're out in the mountains, you almost always stay together at night. You didn't send out patrols at night when you were in the mountains. The company dug in as a unit, and you would put out listening posts,
mm-hmm.
Two or three men, people out to places where you thought were good areas of approach to see if, you know, you put them out 100 to 200 yards,
mm-hmm.
And then everybody else would be dug in a, you know, pretty tight circle, because that's where the NVA were.
Right. Can you discuss some of your combat situations? I know you've mentioned a few here and there, but
yeah,
when you think back, what do you picture? What do you see?
Mostly confusion. When you actually get into combat, it's got to be the most confusing thing in the entire world. You know, there's that wonderful quote by somebody about plans always never survive contact with the enemy or whatever it is, and that's pretty much the case. My first 6 weeks there, we were down in the coastal plain almost exclusively, and I think we got into a firefight that lasted 30-40 minutes my first day in the field, and then we got into another one with a group of around six Viet Cong. That was kind of a joke. We were I shouldn't say it was a joke, but we had a I've been there 3 days now, and my platoon sergeant and I, we were sitting around in this village where there was a well. We were having lunch,
mm-hmm.
and he says Lieutenant McNown, he says, come with me, I want to show you something. And I said, well, I started to get the radio operator and some other people to go with us, and he said, no, we don't need them, just leave your stuff here and we'll go. I just want to show you this. And so we walked out about 200 or 300 yards, and it shows you at that time how, you know, safe they were thinking. They hadn't really seen, other than this little action a couple of days before,
mm-hmm.
and hadn't really seen any action in that area of operation around Duck Foe for 2 or 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we go up to this hedgerow through some dry paddies, and he says, now, you see anything wrong with this hedgerow? And I'm looking at it, and I can't tell anything, you know. And he said, well, he walks up, and he says, well, there's this pineapple plant here. And he said, there shouldn't be a pineapple plant in the hedgerow. And he said, I looked at that, and I realized there was something wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, well, that's strange. He said, I thought I'd left this off. And I said, what? And he said, well, there's a tunnel. There's this pineapple plant is tied to a trap door to a tunnel.
Okay.
And he had a smoke grenade in his hand and said, I'm going to drop this in here and we can see if there's any other entrances to this tunnel. But he said, I'd pull the door off. He said, I guess I put it back on there. And he started tugging on the door, and he said, the thing stuck. He said, this is weird. And suddenly the pineapple plant comes flying off and a grenade comes flying out of the...
Wow.
And he yelled grenade and dropped the... smoke, it was a red smoke, I can see that to this day, in his hand, and we start back paddling through this dry paddy,
mm-hmm.
about as fast as we can,
mm-hmm.
and through the smoke you can see these guys popping up out of this tunnel and shooting.
Wow.
And so we're out there, and we got down in a little divot, and I'm sitting there, there's about six of them in here, and they're coming out, and they're just all shooting and going in two directions. And I looked up and I said, what do we do? And he said, shoot, God damn it, shoot. And so I started shooting. But that was actually the first time I'd ever fired my weapon at anybody. Uh-huh. And it was just sort of an unnatural thing at the time. It got a lot more natural after that.
Mm-hmm.
But and then I heard his M16. I don't know if you've ever fired one, but they make a real distinctive clang when the bolt goes back and locks in place when you fired the last round.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard his lock in place, and he says, do you have any ammunition? He said, do you have a magazine? And he'd even left his magazines back with the rest of them. And so luckily I had mine still being new. I still had them tied on my chest. Mm-hmm. So I gave him some more, and of course by this time, you know, there's all this firing going on, and the rest of the platoon shows up, and we routed him out. So, that was my first, that was my second combat experience, but the first one that I'd had where I'd actually fired my weapon. And so then for the rest of the time we were down there in the coastal plain, but I don't know if I fired more than once or twice at people in the distance. And we had sniper incidents and booby trap incidents, which were always kind of, you know, that was bad. You'd be walking along, you'd hear an explosion, and you just knew somebody was down, you know. And
how did you feel, John, about that first contact you had? Well, can you describe what you felt during and then immediately afterward?
Well, the first, I remember on this particular one, I was just, the first thing, I was stunned that somebody would actually be shooting at me. I mean, because you could actually see people that had gone down behind a paddy dike directly across from us, and they were shooting at us, and you know, the rounds were hitting around us. And I mean, I was just stunned because, you know, I hadn't done anything to these people. What is the, and I was just, and that's why I said, I wasn't even sure even after all that training, what am I supposed to do here?
Mm-hmm.
And he had to tell me to shoot, which was, you know, actually after a while just became the natural thing to do. You know, you get like Pavlov's dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I got to the place where I knew what kind of a weapon somebody was firing at us, and, you know, whether it was friendly, you know, when you hear the noise of a weapon, you could do it in your sleep.
Mm-hmm.
I'd sleep through M16s going off and M60s going off, and the minute you heard an AK-47 or a RPD, I'd be out and rolling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Which was kind of a strange thing to get used to, that you could actually, you know, so like obviously you weren't even sleeping very soundly when you were asleep, but once the adrenaline, I started firing and the adrenaline kicked in, and when we got some help, and of course I got really I guess I was really scared also, because when I found out the guy with me didn't have any extra magazines with him, I thought, oh, and there was nobody else around, and these people were actually coming around on two sides of us.
Wow.
I thought, well, this is, you know, I was pretty scared, and then all of a sudden, you know, the rest of the platoon came up online and started, you know, and then the Viet Cong got up and started running, and we shot some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And when the rest of the people got up there, I got up and started maneuvering with them.
Mm-hmm.
And the one good thing about that was, number one, it was sort of funny to everybody that we'd gone out there without anybody, and then Sergeant Wright had screwed up, and since it came out okay for us, it wasn't so bad. And the second thing, then after that point, all the people in the platoon kind of accepted me.
Okay.
I mean, because, you know, okay, I'd been shot at, I'd done okay, and so I wasn't such a bad guy.
Right.
And
did they look to Sergeant Wright to kind of see if, yeah, he gave the nod, yeah, this guy's okay, he stood his ground?
A little bit, but they actually saw that I was out there and doing something, and I got jumped up and gone after the Viet Cong with them, and I think I just kind of picked up my own credibility with the people that were there. And then Sergeant Wright always, I think he was a little embarrassed about the whole thing, you
right.
know, so that was not... so that wasn't the worst thing that could have ever happened to me either, probably.
Right.
And so that was my really, those two incidents, other than a couple of sniper incidents and things, were my only combat experience until mid-September of 68, when we went out to Hawthorne Special Forces Camp. Later on found out, I guess they told us at the time, you don't remember these things, but later on, it was the 22nd NBA Regiment was trying to overrun Hawthorne. It was all part of the caisson. They'd come down through Long Bay, and then they'd hit, I think, Trebong Special Forces Camp, and they were, you know, just trying to overrun some of the Special Forces Camp.
Mm-hmm.
And Hawthorne was probably past the first range of mountains due west of Quang Ngai City.
Okay.
And we'd been on LZ Liz for about a week and a half. The 3rd of the 1st, which was on the other battalions in the 11th Brigade, had been out there, and we were getting information back that there was tanks out there, and of course they'd used tanks up at Long Bay, and but there was intelligence that said the NVA had gotten tanks out there. Now after I found out more, I would have no idea how they would get a tank out there, but you know, there were some old French roads that maybe they could have brought them over from Cambodia, but it would have been a tough go, especially not to be seen, I think, but they did lots of things like that. So, anyway, so the rumor was they had tanks, and the 3rd of the 1st definitely was taking a lot of casualties. And about the 15th of September, they took us down onto the LZ where you get picked up there off of Fire Base Liz, and we'd been running patrols out and then listening to what was going on, they were supposed to send in a bunch of helicopters and pick us up, and we sat out there all day, and nobody ever came.
Mm-hmm.
And the bad thing was they brought the chaplain in to talk to us before we went down there, and that's the first time we'd ever seen a chaplain.
Uh-huh.
And so we knew that, you know, things weren't you know, probably going real well. That, you know, all of a sudden the chaplain shows up to talk to us.
Right.
And
did everybody else have the same feeling about
that? Oh, yeah, because some of the guys had been there several months and never seen a chaplain. It wasn't a real bright move on somebody's part. But but then nothing happened. So we go up and, you know, we have dinner, and everybody was, you know, we had access to liquor there. And so we were, you know, everybody was having a few drinks and stuff. And then the next day, they sent us down there again, and we're sitting down there and been sitting there 2 or 3 hours, and all of a sudden, all these Hueys appear.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting next to Sergeant Wright, and I never will forget. He looked up, because normally when we went someplace, they would send like 3 or 4 Hueys, and we'd go in and secure the LZ, and then they'd bring everybody else in a Chinook.
Mm-hmm.
And there was about, I don't know, must have been 20 Hueys coming in. And he turns around to me and he says, "Well, Lieutenant, we're in for this shit now." And so they picked us up, and actually we landed on the runway up there at Hawthorne Special Forces Camp, and the captain goes in and talks to them, and by this time it's 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they tell us to head north, that there's supposed to be an arms cache up there.
Okay.
And so we take off, and first time I'd ever seen very many water buffalo together, and that was scary because they didn't like Americans. They, you know, we didn't smell right, and they would kind of start snorting and charging around and doing some things. And they're a pretty scary animal. You see all those little kids out herding them, and you think, well, what, they're like cows. But when they start moving, they're pretty scary. So we'd seen a lot of water buffalo, and we went up over this one set of little hills and started seeing a lot of NVA sign, Ho Chi Minh sandal prints, ran into a couple of booby traps, but we found them. They weren't as good as putting them out as the Viet Cong were.
Mm-hmm.
It started raining really hard as we moved down into this valley on the other side of this one little range of mountains. I guess they were just good-sized hills, and pouring rain. This was sort of like in between the dry season and the monsoon, we hit this stream in the middle of these paddies, and we couldn't find it. It took us a long time to find a way to cross, and when we did, it was up to some of the guys' neck. We had to be really careful moving across that. By the time we got across it, and up to some ground that was a little bit higher on the other side, it was getting dark. And so we had to find a place to dig in. And as we were going down this trail on this little ridge, mm-hmm. we kept running into more NVA sign and more booby traps that had been obviously hastily set. And nobody was hit. We kept finding them. We were seeing the tripwires. People were being really careful. And so we pulled back out, went around the edge of this little ridge and found a kind of a flat spot off to the side, and mm-hmm. we dug in there, and it was raining so hard you couldn't dig in very well. The size of the foxholes were collapsing as you dug, and so you ended up with these little shallow pits that were full of water. Mm-hmm. And my platoon was looking into a place where we only had about a 10-yard field of fire, and then the trees got really thick, and mm-hmm. there was almost like a fire break coming through there. So we dug in on one side of this fire break and couldn't see anything, and put out two LPs out into the trees. And then we had first platoon, I know, was dug in over on our right, and mm-hmm. third platoon was actually facing the paddies. And there was a huge argument between Sergeant Wright and the platoon leader over there where we were tying in, because he'd pulled back about 10 or 12 yards from the edge of this big dike that came in from the paddies. There was kind of a drop-off of about 3.5 feet or 4 feet down to the paddy level that was almost like somebody taking a bulldozer and come through there. It was an embankment. Mm-hmm. And Sergeant Wright was telling him he should be digging in right on the edge of that instead of pulling back a little bit. Mm-hmm. But he went ahead and pull in there, and then we called in final protective fires. And by this time, it was probably 9:30 at night. It was really dark, and CP and the mortars were set up in the middle, and so we had a complete circle. And they were supposed to send out a 6-man LP ambush through the paddies, and about 200 and some yards out, there was a little grove of trees next to the stream that we crossed. And they wanted them to set up in there. And so that's why I was telling you before we were talking about sandbagging.
Right.
And the rumor was that they'd stayed in the perimeter till about 4 in the morning and started to go out then, and got hit on the way out. And then there was the other rumor was they were out there and were trying to get back. So, you know, you never know about that. But
you lost all of them?
All but one.
Okay.
One guy made it back into the perimeter, and I've never talked to him since then. So you know, but about 1:30, 2 o'clock, my LPs started reporting. They could hear movement and hear people talking out in front of their position,
mm-hmm.
And quite a few of them, and they were moving from left to right. And then a little while later, the LPs from the first platoon started reporting. I mean, it was just real thick in there. And so what happened, the NVA went down this trail, came around the same way that we had come over, and actually got in position under this embankment that I was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And about 4, just all hell broke loose. I mean, I don't know how many. There was a company or more of them. And they really hit that third platoon over on that side. And I mean, there's RPGs, mortars coming in. And, you know, and they fired green tracers, and we used to fire red tracers, and it looked like Christmas, you know. And so we're over there just looking in these trees, waiting for people to come, you know, out of these trees 10 yards in front of us. And we never even got a shot fired from that area. So but the third platoon, I think they had the 5 men killed and 12 wounded, I think. So mm-hmm. they pretty much, you know, lost over half their people there.
Mm-hmm.
And if it, we'd called in those final protective fires the night before, and we started calling in, you know, the shrapnel was just flying every place. And I think that's all that saved us, really,
mm-hmm.
because they knocked out 2 or 3 positions over there, and the CP kind of made a secondary line and held that. about dawn, they disappeared.
Okay.
And so then we, you know, we cleaned up, you know, dusted off the people. Another company that was supposed to have been moving at night never actually moved, showed up at that point. Anyway, that's what Captain Adams says. I don't know. You know, I didn't know anything about who was supposed to be doing what.
Mm-hmm.
And we got together across the paddies, then going back after, the, you know, there was, you know, some blood and some stuff, you know. There was, you know, we'd obviously hit some of them. You can't do that much shooting not hit somebody. We'd actually hit a lot of people, I think. But and we crossed over and hit another hedgerow on this little ridge line across from us. It was probably 400 or 500 yards across the paddies, and it took us a while to find the fire break in it. So we, my platoon, we were stuck out in the middle of the paddies while they was looking. I finally got tired, and we moved off to the left, and we find this fire break, and then we became the point platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And as we moved up, all of a sudden somebody noticed some NVA in a little. There was. It was literally like a fire break, like you'd see in the forest. And up at the top of the ridge, there was a circle. And in the middle of the circle, there was like a little bamboo thicket.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody saw some movement in this bamboo thicket. And we went into fire and maneuver immediately. Matter of fact, Fort Benning would have been proud. It was just almost a perfect example of what you're supposed to do when you run into that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even sure I gave but one order. And had a really good bunch of fellows in. And so we overran this little four-man position up there and then hit two more someplace else and overran them. And it turned out we'd come into, I don't know if it's the area these people had been in the night before, but there was all kinds of packs and food and Bangalore torpedoes and mortar rounds. I mean, we got pretty much a whole Chinook full of stuff out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we picked all this stuff up, and they brought in a Chinook, and the colonel shows up. And it's kind of funny because by that time I was just wearing whatever uniforms came out, and it didn't have my name or my rank or anything on them.
Right.
And the colonel wanted to know who was in charge, and somebody pointed to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he came over, and he really chewed me out for not having on, you know, my, because you could get your uniforms laundered if you were an officer and have them set into the field. And I was firmly convinced that even though it was all black stuff, it still made you look different from everybody else. And so, you know, what was the point of doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And so I got a grease pencil and wrote my name on it and put my my rank and stuff on the collar. And so from then on, if I heard he was coming, that's what I'd do before he got there.
John, let me ask you real quick about the night before and during that the fight. What were you doing specifically? Do you remember kind of your actions?
Yeah, well, I was asleep, you know, of course. We had a poncho hooch, and my RTO and I were in a two-man, and we had a position that was probably 2.5 feet deep, and it was really a fire pit, and we finally ended up giving up trying to dig a foxhole and just kind of dug a hole that you could lay in, kind of. I think your feet were sticking out. It was so small. And when we started getting the reports from the LP, you know, about 1:32 o'clock in the morning, and I alerted the perimeter that we might have to bring these guys back in, you know, where we'd open up and leave a fire lane for them to come back through if we needed to. And we started, you know, contacting the CP, and we finally had to go back down and wake somebody up. Whoever was supposed to be on radio watch had fallen asleep. And that was probably about 3 when we did that, because we kept getting reports, and nobody was talking in the CP.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were pretty much wide awake, and then I tried to go back to sleep, and when the fire had started, I'd already, you know, I'd put my boots back on. I was completely dressed by then, because we'd been getting all this information. So, I mean, I was pretty much, and I just rolled and picked up my rifle and got in my position and started, you know, and we coordinated getting our LPs back in.
Mm-hmm.
And so we brought them back in, and then we just sat there waiting to get hit.
Right.
And listening to what was going on the other side, and I kind of had I was talking to my people that were on that flank that were tied in, but it looks like I think the people on my extreme left flank from my platoon got off, you know, fired some rounds. But other than that, we just were sitting there waiting to see what was going to happen from behind us or if we needed to react and go, you know, go over. And I mean, it was just a real scary deal because you were just sitting there waiting and all hell was breaking loose and there was fire going over you and shrapnel going over you and you just kept thinking, well, they're hitting them that hard, they're going to come around over here through these trees pretty soon, and we aren't going to see them until they're right on top of us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty much it. I mean, that was I remember, anyway. So.
You thought you performed adequately?
I thought I did. You know, our job was to hold that side of the perimeter unless we were told to do something else, and we had a reaction force ready to go. We designated certain people that in case we had to go and reinforce the third platoon.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then that whole incident though led to a disaster later on, about 2 days later, I guess, or maybe it was the next day even.
What happened?
Well, the third platoon leader, who was he was a Ranger Airborne West Point, very, very gung-ho, dynamic kind of guy. But he was really, he thought he'd been made to look bad and he'd lost all these people and he really wanted revenge. I mean, the guy was just, he wanted to take the point, he wanted to stay on point. He was on Captain Adams all the time. Let us get out there. We want to get these guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This was actually early in the morning on the 17th, I guess, when we got hit. And on the 18th, about noon, we'd stopped. We were now going southwest of Hawthorne. They'd pulled us back to the Special Forces camp. We'd gone back in there. And then on the night of the 17th, we dug in with a couple other companies because mm-hmm. everybody'd been getting hit, not as badly as we had. But, you know, we'd been running into all kinds of people. And so we went southwest of the Special Forces camp because there was supposedly something going on down there, and we stopped, and I actually think they brought us in a hot meal that day because I remember paper plates. That's kind of a funny thing to remember. I don't remember eating a hot meal, but I do remember seeing paper plates. I'd incurred Captain Adams' wrath a little earlier because we were coming through this real thick bamboo and my platoon was pulling up the rear, and he called me and asked me for our position. I hadn't been watching. I'd just been following the people in front of us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was pretty hacked off at me, I remember, that day. And I thought it was totally unjustified, but that was, you know, that was his deal if he wanted to do it. He was pretty upset too, you know. We had taken all those people and didn't, you know, hadn't gotten a single NVA to show for it, you know. We picked up all the equipment and stuff the next day and got, you know, the six there. But we came up over this little ridge and down through a little finger of trees, and there was a big expanse of paddies, and we crossed at the narrowest point, and third platoon that had been hit early the morning before was in the lead, and we were second, and they went around this little finger of trees and started up over another one of these large paddy dikes like I was describing earlier, and the point man went into the trees and he just erupted. The NVA were dug in behind this hedge at the edge of the paddies, and point man was hit. And as soon as the fire started, we were over behind this finger of trees and weren't taking any fire. And we dropped our rucksacks, and I took a bunch of people back into the trees thinking I could flank them. And
mm-hmm.
it just automatically went back in there.
Mm-hmm.
Started moving through the trees, and it was really thick. We were having a hard time. We kept finding spider holes and trenches and things, but there was nobody in them at the time. And but there obviously there's been a lot of NVA, and they still had utensils and things out. So, you know, they must have seen us coming over the ridge line and set up.
Right.
So 3rd Platoon, I guess, got reorganized under this little dike, and decided to try to cross this little, you know, 5 to 10 yard stretch of grass, flat ground, into this hedgerow.
Mm-hmm.
And made an assault into the hedgerow, and Lieutenant Enners, the platoon leader, and his radio man were killed inside the hedge. Or at least they went down. The rest of the platoon came back out, and unbeknownst to me, Sergeant Wright had taken the majority of my platoon and moved over to support him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got back in there and started taking some fire, and my RTO said, I don't think there's the platoon's with us. And I said, what do you mean? He said, I keep hearing Sergeant Wright talking to the weapons squad and two of the other squads, and sure enough, so we did a, you know, pass up the count where you...
Mm-hmm.
And it gets to me, and I'm two men back from... There's two men in front of me, and everybody else should be behind me, and the count's 8.
Wow.
And I said, well, that can't be right. So we stopped and passed up the count again, and it's still 8. Well, we decided we'd still try to maneuver along and see if we could, you know, find a place where we could get some kind of a little flanking thing going. But we tightened up a little bit, and I wasn't feeling as confident as I had been because I thought I had 35 people.
Right.
And so we were back in there, and we were a little disoriented because how thick it was, and we were moving toward the fire, but we couldn't find a good line of approach.
Mm-hmm.
And we could hear, you know, people are yelling, you know, 3-6, which was the call sign for the 3rd Platoon leaders down, and Captain Adams was going nuts, wanting to know what everybody was doing, and it was just all kinds of, you know, it was just a huge amount of fire going on. And so the battalion commander was flying over, and it's Charlie, and he found out we were back in the trees, and he told us to pop smoke. And so we popped a yellow smoke so he could kind of determine where we were and try to help us maneuver in to mm-hmm. a clearer area. And when we did that, they popped smoke around us.
Okay.
And he told us to get out of there because we actually had smoke being popped all the way around us except for the way that we came in.
Wow.
And so we backed out and got back with the rest of the platoon, and then... Captain Adams had the 3rd Platoon try to assault into there again, and we tried to come in from the flank right on the edge of the trees, the edge of the paddies,
mm-hmm.
and it was so thick we ended up being divided into 3 different lines, really, instead of doing an online assault. And my squad leader on the line nearest to the trees was killed. And at that point, he actually come across NVA in a spider hole kind of a situation, and... had pulled a grenade to throw in, and this guy popped up and shot him in the hand. He dropped the grenade, and it went off and killed him. That's what I was told. I was in the middle section,
mm-hmm.
and we were having to crawl. It was so thick with vines and stuff, we were having to try to cut and crawl our way back. So then they pulled everybody out, and we pulled out, reorganized again, sent my platoon and another platoon, tried to get back in again because the battalion commander wouldn't let us call artillery and drop back and call artillery in because he was concerned that, you know, somebody was still alive inside the hedgerow.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all pretty sure that they were dead because people had seen them go down. Mm-hmm. But finally, you know, we'd lost another 20 people. Wounded, trying to go in there and get him. And he finally let us pull back, and we called in artillery for about, I don't know, 30, 40 minutes, I guess.
On that position.
On that position. And then we went back over, and by that time it was getting toward dusk. And I took my platoon and another platoon, Brad Burgraff, the lieutenant from... 1st Platoon
mm-hmm.
had been hit, so he'd been dusted off. So I was the only platoon leader left out. So I went over with two platoons, and we got online under this little dike again and threw grenades and charged over and they were gone. So, which was a pretty good feeling actually, because that was not a, it was sort of like World War One. We just kept going over the top of this dike into this hedgerow, you know, and it wasn't very far, but it was, there wasn't any cover either.
Right.
So we went in, found the bodies, and Captain Adams pulled the rest of the company back, and they dug in on the hill a kilometer or so to the rear, and he left us to bring, my platoon, to bring the bodies back and to set up for him to medevac the bodies. And so we pulled back across from where, to where the company had been set up on the other side of these paddies, and there was kind of a big, I don't know, like a field surrounded by trees, big square field. And we put the bodies in there thinking somebody was going to come for them. And it, by this time it was dark. We, it was dark while we were getting them back across. And that's when I found out how, you know, you talk about dead weight, you're not kidding. One of these fellows, Sergeant Kermit Williams, was probably 6 foot four and weighed about 230 pounds. And that was a...
Well,
it was a load. Anyway, we put them in there. We sat around, and it was 11 o'clock before they finally brought something in to get them out. And the guy turns on his landing light, which I guess they have to do. But, you know, of course, we didn't know where the NVA were, and there was no support around. The rest of the company was off another kilometer on top of a hill. And we were a little concerned that they'd lit us up like that, you know.
Right.
And I remember, and the bad thing was we had them covered with ponchos, the three dead men. And the helicopter, of course, blew the ponchos off, and it was a, you know, and this light came down. And that's one of the things I remember. It's not a good memory at all. It was just a really bad thing. And So we got the bodies on the helicopter, and then we went up and joined the rest of the company. And Captain Adams had them dig positions for us, so that was one good thing. By the time we got back up there, it was probably midnight or a little after, and we already had our positions dug for us, so that was sort of a treat.
Right.
And then didn't do next couple of days. They pulled us out because by this time, we probably had 30 men wounded and eight killed, I guess. So we'd taken a lot of casualties. And so they gave us another deal. We went up. We were supposed to do something. They sent us up on top of this hill, and they were supposed to tell us where to move off to find something, and they never could get their act together, so we just sat there all day. And then they sent helicopters back to us one at a time. We only had one Huey, and so they ferried us back into the Special Forces camp. And we dug in on this little hill at the end of the runway. And I'm pretty sure the NVA didn't know we were there because they brought us back one helicopter at a time, so it didn't look like, you know, any kind of a unit had come back in.
Right.
And that night, they hit every outpost at about 3 in the morning simultaneously. And there was 7 or 8 outposts around the Special Forces camps on the high ground. The camp itself was in the valley next to the Songchukuk River. And there was a little outpost directly across from us that was at the end of the Special Forces camp and at the same end of the runway we were on. And it was a dug-in position with bunkers and wire and all that stuff, you know, just a little knoll with a, you know, a fortification on top of it. And at the bottom of it was the main village for this area. And so the next morning we're up there thinking, boy, this had been a real show the night before, you know.
Right.
We'd been seeing all this stuff go on. And all they reported all the outposts had held. Except they weren't sure about the one directly across from us. But there hadn't been any firing at that one. And as it turned out, the NVA had moved in one side and the CIDGs had moved back into, they started finding the ones that were supposed to be up there back in the main camp. And none of the CIDGs would go up there, so they told us we had to go take the camp back and the little fortification, OP-7. And So we set up, and we didn't really believe anybody was up there because nothing had happened, you know. We thought, well, these guys just, you know, left. And it was, you know, completely smooth sides with barbed wire and the whole business around it. And we got on two flanks. Sergeant Wright was actually over the first platoon now because they'd lost their platoon leader. And so Captain Adams had put him over that platoon. I had second platoon, and we brought our XO in to be over the third platoon. And they'd swept by the bottom of the hill because we'd seen somebody laying wire coming out of the village and had shot him out on this road that led southwest out of the village. And that was kind of an odd thing to see a North Vietnamese guy laying wire, you know. That was not a good sign, probably, but we just thought, well, that is certainly strange. And
John, let me ask you, quick, how battle fatigued are you at this point?
We're tired. I mean, we are just really tired, and we're, you know, we're down to really, we probably have two platoons. We're probably down to about 70 people, 75, 76 people, I think, and everybody's, but the day before we hadn't done much, you know, we just sat on top of that hill, so we had some rest up there, everybody got some sleep a little bit, so it's not as bad as it had been like the night before, and you know, compared to what, you know, some of the units went through, I feel probably wasn't a whole lot of, you know, I mean, if you look at some of the things you read about, you think, well, that, you know, it wasn't as bad as that. So,
was it hard to pick yourself up and just keep going day after day like this in this kind of combat environment?
Yeah, you were tired, but once you got moving, you were okay. I mean, you're really kind of going on adrenaline once you start moving because you just are pretty concerned about what's going on around you. And when you stop, you're just worn out. But as long as you're moving, you're just running on reactions and you know, I mean, that truly is where the training kicks in. I mean, like I say, that day that we overran a little outpost after we'd been hit the night before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was when I think of perfection, that's as close to perfection as I've ever seen in my life from anything. I mean, people just, and we were tired and beat then, you know, and been hit the night before and so hard, or that early that morning.
Right.
And everybody did exactly what they were supposed to do without anybody screaming and yelling. And I mean, it was just, if you'd been up in a helicopter looking down someplace, it would have looked like somebody had choreographed the movement. I mean, everybody did what they were supposed to do. And I really think the training and the fact that we had good squad leaders and platoon sergeant, I think all that stuff kicked in, you know. And now,
how were you psychologically?
Worried. You know, I thought, no, we pretty much got our ass kicked before. And I thought that we were going to go out and we were going to run into some more of these people and we were going to do our job and get it done. But I wasn't, I'm not a big revenge person. I'm sort of more of a thinker, and I'm thinking, okay, so now what are we supposed to do? What do we, you know, how do we do this? How do we do that? And you know, if we run into them, fine. If we don't run into them, better. I mean, that's pretty much my attitude the whole time I was there. After I figured out that I pretty much figured out after my first day that it really wasn't worth it. I mean, when we worked with those national policemen and they were beating all those people and, you know, doing stuff, I tell them, there's something just not right here. And so my whole, from that point on, my attitude was, well, we're going to do the job, but we're not going to go out and really look for trouble. You know, I wasn't big on, you know, making sure we had the highest body count in the division or anything. It wasn't a game.
Right.
And So anyway, so my attitude was, we're going to go out and you know, if they open up, we're going to do everything as right as we can. You know where we are, know where, of course, like I say, later the next day, he asked me, and I was the last platoon back, so I'm just following around. So obviously wasn't doing as well at that as I could have, and I wasn't probably functioning as well as I could, but I think I got better as the week got on. This became, you know, it just became after the second day when we lost. Now I'm the only platoon leader left.
Mm-hmm.
And I lost all my squad leaders trying to get the body out.
Mm-hmm.
So there was me and, you know, a couple of guys who had been fire team leaders, special spec fours, were running, you know, the squads. And lost my machine gunners. I mean, we were down to probably 20, 21 men, had the strength of 35 when we went out. And so after the second, third day, we're down, you know, we'd lost over 30% of the platoon.
Okay.
And
but everybody performed very, very well, is what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, really, really had. I think third platoon was pretty much combat ineffective by that time because their platoon leader, platoon sergeant, had lost their platoon leader, and they'd lost more men than we had. I think they were probably down to 15, 16 men. Maybe not, but they were, you know, we were all down to 20 or so. It's just a hard question to answer, but we were still functioning. I mean, we were not combat ineffective by any means. And so.
John, did you have to deal with the issue of fear frequently or infrequently, or how much? And I'm talking about you and the men in your unit.
I think it was, some people were afraid. I mean, there were some people that could not function.
Really?
We had a couple of people that just, you almost had to put somebody behind them to make sure they'd go forward when you assaulted on something.
What would they do? Would they just freeze? Or
just freeze up. They just didn't, you know, they just couldn't handle it. And they weren't bad people. I don't mean to, they just couldn't handle the environment. And the Army, you know, they didn't have a way to test, or they didn't, to see if a guy was a good infantryman or not, you know. We had a couple of fellows that after I became company commander that I knew just couldn't do it. And I got them jobs in the rear, and they performed great. And I mean, they made sure that, you know, when I put two of them in resupply, and we never had a problem again about poncho liners and stuff like that because they'd been out in the field for quite a while, and these guys were their friends, you know, and they made sure that they took care of us. And I mean, it turned out to be a good move. At first, a couple of the fellows were really mad because they thought they'd been rewarded for being chicken or whatever you wanted to call it. But you know what? They just couldn't function. There was odd things. So we had a fellow that I found out died a few years ago, and I didn't, you know, we just had been able to track him down and find out he'd already died, but a fellow named Ken Mackey, good guy, assistant machine gunner, but Ken Mackey had platinum hair, and he'd take his helmet off at night, and you could probably see him for 300 yards. I mean, he would just be like a torch out there.
Right.
And it really worried Sergeant Wright. And Sergeant Wright would just scream at him and you know, get your helmet back on, Mackey. And I always thought that probably gave our position away more than Mackey did. But, you know,
it's screaming.
I mean, he would just go nuts when he would take his helmet off if the moon was out at night.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally convinced him that what he needed to do was, Sergeant Wright did, it was convince Mackey that he needed to re-up and take another two-year tour and become a generator mechanic, because that's what he wanted to do, and he wanted to become some kind of a mechanic, you know, after he got out of service. And Mackey, by that time, had seen enough combat that he thought maybe that wasn't the worst thing that could happen. So there was weird things that happened sometimes, that you know, especially with some Sergeant Wright. It wasn't superstitious, but, I mean, you know, he tried to be in control of the situation as much as he could. And Mackey, he couldn't do anything about Mackey's hair, you know, and it just really worried him. As I said, we had some people that just couldn't function. And you had some people that were just absolutely magnificent riflemen. You know, I mean, they were just born to do the job, and you don't know why, because some of them were from the city, some of them were from the country. I mean, it wasn't, you know, the Sergeant York thing. It was just some people were good at it, and it seemed like nothing could touch them. I mean, I have a good friend from the platoon that went through, you know, in his entire tour in the field, and not only was in the stuff where we lost all the people at Hawthorne Special Forces Camp, but in June the next year, that they, you know, lost that many people in about 4 hours. And he never got a scratch, and he was an aggressive, really good rifleman, but for some reason he was just charmed, you know, and people wanted to be around him, you know. And there was something about Frank. If you were with Frank, you felt fairly safe because you knew nothing was going to happen to Frank. So, and so there were people. There were, you know, it was just you got this sense of people about, you know, who was lucky and who wasn't about things. We had a guy named Al Shunk that every time he'd be in the field 2 weeks and get hit again. You know, I mean, this guy just couldn't. You know, his third Purple Heart, we finally got him out, you know, permanently. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he ever spent more than 6 weeks in the field. And he spent most of his tour in the hospital, but it was never bad enough they sent him home.
Right.
And it was weird that he kept coming back to our unit, because a lot of times after you'd been out for quite a while, you'd come back and he'd send you to some other unit, which wasn't very good either. But Al just kept coming back, and it was just strange. But as far as I think, I don't know if fear is exactly the right word. I think you were afraid, but it was more dread. You just it was a sense of all encompassing waiting for something to happen. I mean, you just spent, you know, every day, unless you'd been in time for, and when things didn't happen for a long time, all of a sudden you let up a little bit, and that wasn't good either. You know, if you were in an area where you hadn't had any contact for weeks and weeks, you had to be careful not to get sloppy at that point. You know.
What would you do about that as a leader to try to combat that?
You just had to keep reminding people, you know, and spreading out, you know, about doing the stuff that you were supposed to do, and that's about all you can do. I mean, you just and you know, try to get the people that knew what they were doing, you know, to help the people that didn't know what they were doing, and just keep reminding them to spread out and to check the weapons, and just do all those little routine things, and hope that, you know, and I think that's part of what happened. They'd gone a long time without seeing any combat in June of 68, and I think that when they first got hit, they didn't react as well as they might have, because they had so many new people, and they'd been so long without they didn't have a single platoon leader or platoon sergeant that had seen any heavy combat.
Right.
And they took a lot of casualties the first, you know, a couple of hours.
John, how much did humor come into play when you were in the field?
Well, you know what? There's lots of funny things. I mean, it was people told jokes, and of course, a little graveyard humor. I mean, a lot of times they were a little cynical, but I think without people keeping some sort of sense of humor and some sort of perspective on things, you would have gone nuts.
Right.
And things that were funny probably may not be funny to people who weren't there. But we still, I mean, when we get together, sometimes my jaws hurt when I get back from laughing so hard. But we had a Kit Carson scout, for example, that probably had been a Viet Cong. You know what a Kit Carson scout was. Somebody
yes,
had been a former Viet Cong and had Chu Hoi, you know, kind of gone over to the government. But we figured he was probably maybe 16 years old, 17 years old at the most. And he'd probably been a Viet Cong for 2 weeks or something, you know, and didn't like it, you know, it was uncomfortable. Anyway, that was our theory. And he was just pretty much worthless. But they insisted that we keep him, you know, that was part of the deal. They wanted to sign these Kit Carson scouts, as they called them, to each unit. And we found out he'd never had a weapon when he was in Viet Cong. He just carried stuff the 2 weeks he was with him or whatever it was.
No wonder he didn't like
it. And so, you know, when he got an M16, he thought this was just, he was just about as exciting, just like a little kid with a new toy, which he was. And he'd go out as soon as we'd set up and start shooting his weapon every night. And then we were not real happy with this, and we couldn't keep him to do it. And so finally, Dave Bushy, who was our medic, figured out that, you know, the guy liked to drink a beer, and he'd give him 280-milligram Darbons and a beer as soon as we pulled in. And the guy would literally pass out about halfway through the beer. And we just leave him laying out there in the rain. You know? And I mean, it's not funny. You know, it's not a nice way to treat people. But we all thought this was absolutely hilarious. And then one day he got really upset because he figured out what was going on, and he actually locked and loaded on Bushy.
Wow.
And we had to threaten to kill him. And we got rid of him then, you know.
Right.
So they took him out. But, you know, and we, you know, a lot of the guys thought he was trying to tell the VC where we were, and I don't think that was it at all. I think the guy was just not playing with a full deck, maybe, and it was just exciting. He was young, and it was just cool to have have his own gun. And I remember, and everybody kind of laughed, first time I ever saw a land leech. I didn't realize leech lived any place but in the water. But when you got up into the heavy jungle, the leeches were literally living on the jungle floor and in trees.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going up this hill, and I'd been there about 2 weeks. We had an exercise where we were supposed to go out to Bato Special Forces Camp and act like we were relieving them. And the 3MAF commander was in the helicopter watching us do this. And I think we took 4 or 5 heat casualties because they were making us walk in the paddies instead of on the dikes, you know, across several hundred yards of paddies, assaulting across this into this hill. You know, totally unrealistic exercise. But, you know, they had this guy upstairs, and they set up a temporary fire base, you know, on the spot, you know, and it was just like a big exercise, except you could have really run into somebody. So once we got into the trees, we went into single file because they couldn't see us anymore, and we had to make our way up the hill. And we're about halfway up the hill, and I was not in good shape when I got there, and this was 2 or 3 weeks later, and I'd made it across, but I thought I was going to die. I mean, I was just barely able to move. But I kept up, you know, because that's what you do. But I wasn't functioning as, you know, Sergeant Wright was running the platoon, because, I mean, it was just everything I could do to keep from, you know, falling out. And so we're going up this hill, and we're in the shade, and, you know, we stopped because they're trying to find a way up. And I looked up, and coming across these leaves were this little thing, like, they looked like inchworms to me. I mean, they were a couple inches long, and they moved like an inchworm, you know, that kind of movement that you associate with an inchworm, where they pull their back end up. And I turned to Sergeant Wright, and I said, well, I didn't know they had inchworms in Vietnam. And he says, where? And I'm showing him, and there's just like hundreds of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he yells, leech, and everybody drops their pants and starts stripping their clothes off. And I'm sitting there with my mouth open, you know, what are these guys doing? And they're all getting out their insect repellent, which had alcohol in it, would shrink the things up if they got on you.
Uh-huh.
And I remember to this day that deal, because I was sitting there and I show him these things, and instead of telling me what they are, he yells leech and everybody starts stripping. There were a lot of things that were kind of, you know, that were funny. And that's the good things. And when you had a character like Sergeant Wright, for a platoon sergeant, you had lots of stories of, you know, his RTO was a fellow named Nick Polizzi, who were still good friends. And Nick was married at the time. He was a PFC, and the promotion orders came out, and so we were calling in who was to be promoted to Specialist 4, and Nick's name was on the list, and I'd been there. I hadn't been there all that long, so Sergeant Wright was pretty much making out, you know, who the promotions were. He talked to me about it, but I didn't know, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Nick's lunch, we just called in the people to be, you know, put on the promotion order. And the next thing I know, I hear Sergeant Wright and Nick screaming at each other. Nick's Italian and, you know, has pretty good temper on him when he... And what had happened, Sergeant Wright had opened a can of meatballs and spaghetti from his sea ration, mm-hmm. and Nick had said, "How do you eat that crap?" Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things everybody liked. But, you know, Nick being Italian, so he just thought it was, he wouldn't eat meatballs and spaghetti because it was just beneath him to even call it Italian food.
I understand completely.
And so they get in this huge argument. And Sergeant Wright's telling him that, you know, the Army wouldn't put it in there if it wasn't good and it was the best stuff that you could possibly get. I mean, just typical, you know, full lifetime Army kind of stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. And Nick's telling him bullshit, and they're yelling at each other, and Nick loses it and says, "Look at you, stupid pineapple." and that did it, and all of a sudden Sergeant Wright comes over, picks up my radio phone, which is on the company net, and calls in and cancels Nick's promotion.
Oh, boy. How did Nick take that?
Not well, because that was a big pay increase, and he was married. Mm. And Nick, oh, my God, I thought they were going to kill each other before it was all over. And then about a week later, he calls back in, and, you know, he said, "You know, I shouldn't have done that." He said, "We need to get him on the promotion orders." But that's just how he was. He was a hugely volatile man, and we all have these stories about him where he would do something like that. He was I think he'd been busted a couple times for drinking or something, and so he was like an E6, but he wore E7 stripes. At one time, a staff sergeant wore two rockers in this old Army, you know, old Army and new Army stuff. And for mm-hmm. some reason, some of those people could still do that. I never did quite understand how they grandfathered some things in. And so after this day, I was telling you about where we had to take this outpost back the next day. It hopped on. Sergeant Wright had performed really well, which wasn't surprising. And Colonel Gwynn and the Sergeant Major had come up and asked Captain Adams, because he was up there critiquing he had all the people sitting around after we'd gone back and then taken the village back below, after we took the OP back and then took the village below it. Mm-hmm. He was critiquing the first platoon about what they'd done, because they didn't have a platoon sergeant, their platoon leader, and, you know, I mean, and they were probably not the best platoon in the company at the time. I think we had the best, because at that time, just because we had good squad leaders, good platoon sergeant, third platoon was a good platoon, but they were all shot up, and then first platoon had not been running as well the last month or so.
Mm-hmm.
Because their platoon leader was hard a week, and they had a pretty weak platoon sergeant. So Sergeant Wright's talking to them, kind of critiquing what they'd done.
Mm-hmm.
And the battalion commander asked Captain Adams, they said, "Well, you know, what's the deal with him? He seems to be an excellent leader of men, you know."
Mm-hmm.
And Captain Adams is telling him that, you know, he didn't know exactly what, you know, he had a couple of problems, but, you know, that he was a great platoon sergeant. And he said, "Well, we're going to have to get him promoted." And about the time he said that, all of a sudden, Sergeant Wright reaches up and just knocks the hell out of this guy. Hit him right in the face with an open hand, because he wasn't paying attention. And Captain Adams says, "You know, I think that's one of the reasons he hasn't been promoted." and that's just, I mean, that's just how he was. The guy was just hugely volatile, but he was the best combat soldier I ever saw.
Yeah. Did you all get a chance to see him after the war?
You know what? I wrote him a couple of times. I never heard back from him. Found out where he was. And Captain Adams has seen him, and he didn't want much to do with Captain Adams, Captain Adams said. And he died, actually, November 17th. And
right.
He was going to come to Reno.
Hmm.
And we were all just looking forward. Everybody that had served with the guy was just, because he was one of those people you just never forget, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Louis Rios, one of the fellows from our platoon, had gone over to Hawaii, and he and Dick Keeney had gone out and found out from Captain Adams where he was, and spent a day and a half with the guy, and they sent us some pictures, and he was 73, I think, and he was coming to Reno. He told them, yep, I'll be there. But he says, I may not come to any of the dinners. So you guys may have to come down to the bar and see me, but I'm going to come out there.
Okay.
And then he up and died on us, which was one of the more depressing things that I've had happen to me lately, because he was just somebody you just, sort of like your father or somebody you just don't think can die.
Yes.
You know, I mean, he was just absolutely, he would stand up in the middle, I'll tell you a story. Going back to when we took this OP back, mm-hmm. and so we're going up one side of this hill. He's leading the platoon up the other side, and we get up and find a hole in the wire, and I think, well, this is kind of weird. And when now we're, you know, we're 50 meters from the trench line in the bunkers, and we haven't seen anybody, nobody's opened fire. The third platoon had already gone by the bottom of the hill and not taken any fire, and we're pretty much convinced that nobody's in there.
Mm-hmm.
And me and Louis and my RTO, Bob Sheen, go through this hole in the wire, and as soon as we get through the whole air just gets filled with grenades.
Mm.
And they were throwing Chi-Coms, which... It's sort of like a potato masher. You know, it has a handle on it, and it has a friction fuse that you pull. And so when the smoke starts coming out of the handle after the fuse has been pulled, so you can see them coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hit the ground, and they went off, and I got hit not too badly. And the other two guys, one of them had thrown himself back down the hill, and me and Louis went back through that wire about as fast as you can go,
mm-hmm.
and I'm bleeding from the head, and I'm angry. I mean, I never want to be that angry again in my whole life. I mean, it's sort of like if you were in a football game and you got hit in the nose and your nose started bleeding. I mean, that's kind of how I felt. My adrenaline was just so high, and I was so angry about being so foolish and about these people, you know, getting hurt. I mean, that's really what I remember. It's just I was just in a rage, and I go down, and the medic's trying to get me to go back and get dusted off, and I'm just screaming at people, get up this hill, we're gonna, you know, kill these motherfuckers, and I am just enraged, and somebody's yelling at me that there's booby traps on this fence because I'm wanting them to pull this barbed wire fence down so we can get at them.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't care. You get up the hill or I'm going to kill you. And so they pulled the fence down. And I mean, I was serious. I was, you know, if I would have had somebody with disobeyed order, I would have shot him right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just infuriated. And so we get this fence down, and there's a bamboo fence up around there, and we take a bunch of logs and blow the hell out of it,
mm-hmm.
and start on up the hill. And by this time, of course, they're firing at us, you know, with everything they've got. And we keep going up, and I finally make the last little rush and get into the trench, and I'm in a little firing position, and the trench is going either side of me, and we've got NVA in there, and nobody else is in there with me, I notice, and I'm a little concerned about that. But I was just, you know, in this huge rage, and I'm firing down the trench, and all of a sudden, my rifle locked up.
Oh.
And I go from being enraged to being absolutely, totally scared.
Right.
And I, you know, I pull my thing back, and it's still locked up, and it won't fire, and I finally change magazines, and then it starts firing. It turned out I'd taken a round through the magazine and didn't realize it, and it cut the spring.
Okay.
But in the meantime, Randy Less, who had been the company commander's RTO, and he was a buck sergeant, a young, real young kid. He was 21 or so.
Uh-huh.
But he'd always been wanted to be in second platoon, and he convinced Captain Adams that morning that he wanted to be in second platoon and take over one of our machine guns, because we were, you know, as I told you, didn't have any machine gunners that were trained left, and he had actually worked a machine gun in training or something. He was a pretty good-sized kid, And Randy came up the hill and stood up and started putting fire on the communication trench that was coming down from the middle of the thing and on either side of it, and enabled me to get out of the trench. And then he took a round and went into shock instantly. And I mean, I think he died just right then. And then I got the rest of the people up and we got into the trench. But, you know, it gave us enough time to get in and start clearing out that side. And in the meantime, we're down there and the NVA have pulled back to the other side of the outpost. And we're firing across the middle of the outpost at them. And all of a sudden, Sergeant Wright jumps the trench on his side,
mm-hmm.
runs over, jumps in with us. The only thing I've ever seen like it was, did you see Band of Brothers? And
yes.
They showed that Captain Spear is running through that German position in that town from one side to the other and
yes,
then running back.
Absolutely. I remember
that's
that.
Exactly what Wright did. He jumped across this trench, runs across the center of this position between the two groups, jumps in with us and said, "What are you doing? I've trained these people better than that. You're acting like a bunch of cowards. Get those people over there. And I said, "Your guys aren't even up here yet. What are you yelling about?" He said, "Get their ass moving, Lieutenant." And he jumps up and he runs across the deal again back to them. And he did that twice.
Oh my gosh.
And I mean, nothing ever hit him. And I, you know, I mean, he was an amazing guy. And so we went over and took this corner bunker, and then they came over to the other side, and we took the position. And then we found out they were down in the village, and we had to go down and clear the village out. And so we did that. And by that time, we were out of ammunition. We, you know, run out of grenades. We'd run out of everything. Been resupplied once, and then. About a mile outside of town, there was a CIDG group coming back that had two green beanies with them, and they got hit by a bunch of NVA and were threatening to kill the Green Berets unless somebody came to get them. And we were the only people around. And by this time, I think we'd had... Randy was the only fellow killed that day, and I was wounded, and we had three or four other people had been wounded, but we'd really done pretty well considering. And I think we killed about 60 NVA, and we got some helicopter support going into the village, but we didn't get any on the OP because they didn't want to fire artillery because it was too close to the village and
mm-hmm.
a lot of stuff. And so we just redistributed ammunition, and we actually fixed bayonets, and we went out to get these Green Berets.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, we got there, fired a few rounds, and the NVA took off. And so we picked up the CIDG wounded because they left their people there and took them back into the Special Forces camp. And the next day, they took us out. So,
When you say you cleared the village, what do you mean? How did you do that?
We got online on this hill, and they went through. There were some trenches in there, and a loach came in and had a 60 gunner hanging out of it, and he fired up these trenches, and then we went online into the village, firing down into. We hadn't actually seen these trenches. They were in some in the middle of a whole what we used to call potato fields. They were some kind of a starch plant that they raised that grew above ground, and they would dry them out and cut the stalks into real thin pieces and dry them out, and they look sort of like potato chips, and so we used to call them potato plants, but I have no idea what they really were. But anyway, so we hadn't seen these people. We started down in there, and all of a sudden somebody noticed that, you know, there was NVA in these trenches, and so they came in and started firing out of this loach at them, and we started firing support down there, and after the guy finished up, then we assaulted into the village and went hut to hut and through their trench lines. So thought there was trenches all around the village the CIDGs had made and just cleaned them out. I think there was about 20 of them down there, and the fellow with the loach had gotten most of them. I think there was only four or five that weren't either killed or wounded by the time, because they were in these open trenches and he could pretty much see them, and we were holding them down with our fire coming from up from off the hill.
Mm-hmm. What did you do with the enemy wounded?
There weren't any.
Okay.
Well, And that, you know, and I guess to be honest, there may have been some that were wounded pretty badly when we went through there.
Mm-hmm.
And as we crossed over the trench, I gave the order that I didn't want anything moving behind us.
Okay.
And because we didn't have any people, we still had areas to clean out, and
mm-hmm.
and they were wounded really badly, but and any of them that may have not been dead were dead by the time we swept through.
When you would go hut to hut, can you give me a procedure of how you would go in there? Maybe is it chaotic or is it ordered?
It's pretty much ordered. You have three people that would go in there, and you would you know, you have a guy go in high and a guy go in low and just take a look and see. Most of the villagers were in the little bunkers, the family bunkers they had.
Mm-hmm.
And we really didn't, because we knew there were still villagers in there, there weren't very many. They pulled most of them out back into the camp. And they told us it was all clear, but it wasn't completely clear. But we didn't grenade anything until we'd made sure everybody had a chance to get out, and we were real fortunate we didn't kill any of the villagers as we were going through, but most of them were gone.
Mm-hmm.
Was
it easy to distinguish a villager from these were NVA.
Well, these were NVA,
yeah.
So they were
yes.
They were actually in uniform, you know, they had little green shirts and green pants and
mm-hmm.
you know, they webbing on. I mean, they were NVA. So, and the only people that were left in the village were women and kids, the only ones who were still in there. All the men were in part of the CIDG thing, and they were in the main camp after they'd been hit then.
Okay.
So that wasn't a problem there. Now, when you get out, you know, when you got out in the coastal plain, there was just no telling who was who.
Mm-hmm. And imagine that presented a major problem.
Huge problem. You just, you know, You just suspected everybody was a Viet Cong. I mean, that was the way you operated.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go into a village and round all the people up and put them into a central place and, you know, put them under guard, and then we'd search the village. And we pretty much had procedures on how that worked. So, that was, you know, something nobody liked to do that, just because if you did get fire, it was just, you know, so likely that you might hit somebody, you know, a non-combatant. I think in our company, I mean, we realized that we were over there to be soldiers and not, you know, even though it was not a good situation. I only remember one time that we even started lighting a village up, we got that stopped immediately. But and when I say that, I mean they were setting fire to the thatch on the roofs, the day we hit the minefield and we came down on the other side, there was this village, and there was actually people in there, and we had guys starting to really were pretty upset, and this was probably about 3 weeks after we'd been out in the mountains, and so we were still pretty much under strength, and people were, you know, people were pretty nervous, and we had some guys all of a sudden start lighting, and we got that stop. There was a couple of them were pretty vocal about wanting to do it, and we
mm-hmm.
took a little persuading, but we got it stopped and got out of there so that we didn't have any major incidents. But that was out in the Pinkville, out in the Batanian Peninsula, and it was, like I said, we'd been out there we'd been taking casualties every single day, and
mm-hmm.
snipers, booby traps,
mm-hmm.
and it was just, and it was supposed to be, there wasn't supposed to be any civilians out there. They were supposed to move them all out in every village you go in, and there were still people there, you know.
So bad intelligence.
Well, yeah, and it was supposed to be a free fire zone, but, you know, you can't do that, so.
What about this stereotype, that goes along with some Vietnam veterans and the whole conflict, that the Americans were committing these atrocities in the villages,
yeah.
Burning this and burning that.
Well, it's hard to deny that went on. Matter of fact, Charlie Company of our battalion was the one that committed the My Lai massacre,
uh-huh.
which is something that's pretty hard to get over, because I never understood how something like that could happen. I mean, that was just, it's one thing if somebody gets hit in a crossfire, but that was just, I always thought they should have hung Callie. Talk about poor leadership. It's just unimaginable that an American officer would allow that to happen, or actually lead something like that. And I knew Medina. I don't know if I ever met Callie. And Medina, for everything I knew about him, was a good officer. I didn't hear about that when I was in the battalion. I didn't hear about that really till after it broke and I was back in the States. And
right.
then because I was in brigade intelligence, I got interviewed when I was down at Fort Hood, Texas, by a CID guy out of Washington. And that was a very uncomfortable thing because it turned out I'd had access to files that supposedly had stuff in them. And, of course, I'd never looked back that far because that had been almost it was a year old, and that kind of intelligence, you don't look for something that's a year old.
Right.
And then I guess some of them disappeared from this file. And so they were interested in, what I knew and stuff, which wasn't anything. And, of course, then when they found out I was in the same battalion, they thought, surely you knew something, but I never heard anything about it. And of course, you didn't know that many people from the other usually were operating pretty independently. I knew the company commander there real well, Captain Webb, that came in later on. But other than that, I think he was the only person from Charlie that I know that I knew from Charlie Company very well during the war. So,
John, let me break this for a moment to change up the disc. Okay, John, picking up. What else about, while we're on the topic of Mili, can you give me your thoughts on that? You talked about Medina and Cali, but just in general.
Yeah, I can understand what caused it. I mean, having worked the same area and been in, and I said that's the same area where I told you we actually went in and picked up civilians and put them on the trail in front of us,
which
was the only place we ever did that in. And that was actually out to the west of Mili, but same situation.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually had people, I had people that were really good people, I think would have shot one or two of the people if we would have had different leadership. I mean, they were just so angry that we were taking, like two or three a day. We were losing two or three people a day and nobody to strike back at.
Mm-hmm.
And then, these people know what's going on. That whole area up there was all of Quang-Nai Province, like I said, was very, very sympathetic to the North Vietnamese, and I think Pham Van Dong was actually born in Mo Duc, which was a town right in the middle of our area of operation, and supposedly that's why in 1969 the North Vietnamese just came out of the woodwork, came down in the coastal plain, and we just never had that happen before, and the rumor, actually I don't think it was a rumor, was that the North Vietnamese peace talks that they got into some kind of a hassle about who controlled what, supposedly Key was there and said, well, if you're so good, how come you can't even take Mo Duc, where Pham Van Dong was born, and he was I believe the premier of the Politburo at the time, Ho Chi Minh was the chairman and he was the premier. And there was also two or three other really high-ranking North Vietnamese who were from Quang Ngai province. And it was also, I understand, the French never had control of it during their war. It was just a pretty much a hotbed for the communist nationalist hierarchy in Vietnam. And so I do think that, in retrospect, it seemed like at the time nobody liked this. And in retrospect, everything you can read, something like that's probably the case. Getting back to the point, they never taught us, we didn't know the language, which is always a problem. The people were certainly, alien in the rural Vietnamese areas compared to anything that most of our soldiers had ever seen. And, of course, they were instilling in you, that you can't trust these people. They're farmers by day, Viet Cong by night. They're putting battery acid in Coca-Colas. I mean, there was all kinds of stories that you heard. And I'm sure there was some truth in one of them someplace, kind of like urban legend kind of things, you know. But you'd get in there and you'd hit the booby traps and you'd get sniped at and you'd, you know, get one burst of automatic weapon fire at your point man or at your rear guy out of a village. And when that goes on day after day, the frustration level gets so high, and you want to blame somebody, you know. And so the natural people to blame are the people that are there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's real difficult to leave troops in that kind of an environment for very long,
mm-hmm.
and not have serious consequences because people are scared. Now, you talk about being scared. Walk into a place where you know you're hitting booby traps all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's fear. I mean, the other thing, like I said, there's a sense of dread out in the mountains. You're just waiting for something to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
But once it happens, you know, but on the booby traps, you know it's going to happen. There's nothing to do about it. It's like you're just helpless. And when we hit the, I know when we hit the Bouncing Betty's up there that day, and I think we had just a couple of guys killed, but probably 15, 20 men. Actually, it was 15 wounded in about 30 minutes, and there's nobody there, you know. And you just don't want to take the next step,
mm-hmm.
because you know people behind you are tripping them, people in front of you are tripping them, and you know you're sitting down there doing the thing with the the bayonets or whatever you do,
mm-hmm.
and at that time we didn't have a very good company commander, so that was not a very helpful situation. But he wasn't around too long, so that was good. And you know, the whole business about turning over command, we talked about that before. I think that leads to some of that wasn't the case with Charlie Company, because those people had all come over with the 11th Brigade, you know, so they trained together, come over together. So, I think that's an aberration, but I do think there was a lot of things that took place. You got over there, and people thought the rules didn't count sometimes after they'd been there for a while, you know. And if you had a leader that thought the same thing, it's pretty easy for that to spread in that kind of environment.
Right.
And so, I think, you know, they certainly should have, I mean, there's just absolutely no reason, no acceptable reason, and no excuse for the Army, I think, not to have done something more than they did. And they ruined a lot of people's careers, I think, that, for instance, Colonel Gwynn, that was our battalion commander when I was in the field, had actually been MacBee province chief for Quang Nai province, and his career was ruined because they accused him of being part of the cover-up.
Right.
And I don't think that's true. I don't think anybody believed it. I saw a piece of propaganda, and I told the CID guy that I'd seen after I was in the S2 area, that said, you know, the American wolves with blood dripping from their teeth. I mean, that kind of hyperbole, you know. And you look at something like that and think, well, that's just propaganda, right? Well, it turned out it was about the Mielai thing, and there was some truth to it. But, you know, I saw that, and I thought, well, this is American soldiers wouldn't do something like that, and this is just communists trying to get the people stirred up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in English, you know.
Right.
Which was a wonderful thing. So I suspect that people, Colonel Henderson, who was our brigade commander, mm-hmm. who I know was reprimanded, and
mm-hmm.
people may have heard about that and just didn't believe it. Now, I don't know if they actually talked to what was his name, Rittenhauer, the helicopter pilot that broke the thing after he came home.
Rittenhauer,
uh-huh.
I believe.
But I don't know who he talked to, and certainly if you would have heard that from an American, I think you would have thought there might be something you might have wanted to check into.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the stuff I saw came from Viet Cong sources, and I just didn't believe it. because I'd been up there and I knew things were bad, but, you know, we never had anything like that. You know, it never even occurred to people to bring out all out women and children and start shooting them.
When the story broke, when you heard and you heard it was your
division. I
didn't
believe it, yeah.
You didn't believe it?
No, but you know what? It hurt that it was my battalion.
Mm-hmm.
When I found out it was true, I mean, for a long time, I just didn't really want people to know that. It gave a blank eye to the whole division too. I mean, there wasn't any question about that. I remember one time being at Fort Hood when we were talking about we had some kind of an exercise going on. Of course, we were practicing, you know, saving Europe because we were in the 2nd Armored Division. And they had a scenario where you had all these civilians who were trying to get away, and, you know, what do you do with them? You know, you're trying to advance or in the way, and, and somebody raised his hand, and he said, well, I can give you the Americal solution. And it was a big, everybody started laughing, you know.
Right.
And you know, that really hurt when you'd gone over and tried to serve honorably and your people gave up as much as they did, you know, to have one group like that, you know, all of a sudden just give the entire division, you know, and it'll stick. I'm sure they'll never put the Americal back on active duty because of that. It's my suspicion that you'll never see the 23rd Division ever, and you know, on the roles in the Army again. Although, you know, it's been nice with Colin Powell and Schwarzkopf and people wearing the patch. I mean, in all the movies now, you see all the high-ranking general officers have on Americal patches. So that's been kind of pleasant to see. And it's now people, I think, realize a lot more that you don't hear that kind of thing from other veterans and things that you did at one time. So then, I used to always wear my 11th Infantry Brigade patch because nobody knew what that was.
Right.
So, just to avoid, you know, people talking about it. And I was authorized to do that because people that served up to a certain point, you could do either one.
Do you talk about it with the men now? Has it ever come up?
At the Americal Division, there's people from Charlie Company there, and I actually met a fellow, and I don't remember his name. He was a Hispanic guy, a Latino, down in San Antonio that came out. And I think he'd actually been there.
Wow.
And he seemed to have some real problems. But he found out that most of the people that are from the 120 that were there were all Alpha Company people. And so he hung around with us for a while. But he was real almost introspective and drank too much, and his wife was a very nice person. But I talk, you know, I know some other fellows from Charlie Company, and I'm sure there may be more in Reno than we've seen in some other places, because I know Bill Allen's been trying to get some together, but you know, when we get together, we don't talk about it much because, you know, we're all talking about our own experiences and just what's been happening in our lives since, you know, we came home and things like that.
Of course. Okay. Yeah. John, would you like to break for today?
Yeah, I would. I would. I need to probably.
Okay, John, we were just chatting after we stopped, and go ahead and tell me. You were mentioning some things that you thought of last night that you forgot to mention yesterday that you carried.
I carried, and one of them was a compass, which I think I mentioned a little earlier, but that was a very important thing that you had to have. Carried a camera. I think everybody had a little Instamatic or some kind of a camera. Unfortunately, most of my film got wet. I didn't do a good job. I had a billfold. You know, I kept a little bit of money that I had, and I kept it in a plastic container. But I carried one of the things that was kind of funny, and a lot of people carried some kind of a pinup. I had the Playboy Miss September folded up and in my helmet liner, and it was just another one of those things. I told you how you wanted everything to be exactly in the same place every day when you started off, and I don't know why I did that, but it got to be almost like a good luck piece. So I had Miss September up there, and I think she's the one that later married John McEnroe, if I remember right.
Oh, really?
When I got hit on the outpost, I got hit in the head with the shrapnel, and I bled on it. And I was really, that was another thing later on, I was really upset with those NVA in there about, was they'd ruined my pinup, you know, that I had in my helmet there for 6 months, you know, or 6 weeks. And so I, you know, it took me another month to find the same one. I didn't want just anyone. I wanted that one in my helmet, you know. And after I got hit and didn't get killed, it became even more important to me that there must be something good luck about that particular thing, you know.
Right.
And I carried an air mattress the whole time I was there, and they were pretty heavy at the time. But as I was saying, that one of the good things about them, they give you a layer of insulation between you and the wet ground and the cold once the monsoon started and we were up in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And we were up there one day, and my RTO was sitting there flipping his bayonet, like doing mumbly peg or something. I had my, we were getting ready to, we'd stop for the day, and we're setting up for the evening, had our ponchos, hooch made, and he flipped his knife right into my air mattress and destroyed it, and I didn't have a patch, and I was just so mad at the guy. I just completely almost lost it with him because he ruined my air mattress. So, I mean, that was one of the traumatic experiences of my whole tour, that all of a sudden my air mattress wasn't working. But later on, more and more people started carrying air mattresses just because it did help keep you warm. And then in the monsoon, we all were carrying, we finally found some jungle sweater somewhere, which were a lightweight sweater that, and most of us would, at night when we go into our little poncho hooch, would put that on to help keep warm and be kind of dry, but we kept them in the daytime. You didn't wear them. You put them in a plastic bag trying to keep them dry, because even though they're supposed to dry out pretty fast when it rains all day, every day, pretty hard to dry anything out. So.
Right.
And if we could get some whiskey occasionally, I made the RTO carry a bottle of this terrible rot gut stuff that the Vietnamese, I think it was something made out of rice, and then they would color it with iodine or something to make it look like scotch or something. It was just awful, and we couldn't drink much of it, but when we were up in the mountains, we used to, you know, pass the bottle around and everybody take one swig out of it to kind of warm up, which was probably not according to regulations. And Sheen used to complain all the time because I made him carry this whiskey and he didn't drink. But I wasn't going to carry it. I mean, that's what he was for. He was supposed to be a pack horse. That was good. He was my RTO, a fellow named Bob Sheen, and he real bright kid. He was about 19, and he could run the company. I mean, he had if we were all been hit with Sheen, things would have still functioned. He was just really thought he was really smart and really was. And it's kind of funny, he went into radio, television kind of stuff after he got home. So he found out he liked talking on the radio, I guess. Only fellow I know, they give the Bronze Star for there's actually three ways to get it. Once you get it for service, which is for a period of time, and for valor, and then there's also a Bronze Star for like merit. And he's the only person I ever knew that got the Bronze Star for merit, and that's where you do something for a set but very limited period of time. And during Tet 69, he was on the brigade radio net when it broke out, and all hell was breaking loose, and he stayed on the radio for almost 24 hours, and because he'd had all this experience in combat and being a company RTO later on after he was my platoon RTO, when I moved up to company, I moved him up with me and then got him out of the field later on. He did such a good job, they put him in for the Bronze Star for merit, and I think he's the only person, I didn't even know they had one. So, he's a good fella, except he did put a hole in my air mattress, and I've never forgiven him for that, because it took me 2 or 3 days to get a new one out. So,
right.
So that was it.
Okay, we'll go ahead and stop for today then.
Okay.